following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
Emmy award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of six live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
And welcome back to Corolla Classics for November 17th, 2019. Happy Sunday. We got a heck of a show for you. First, let me introduce us. My name's Chris Loxamana, executive producer of the Adam Carolla Show. And with me, as always, Corolla archivist, superfan Giovanni.
Lord of the Love Line.
Is that what they're calling you now?
By they, you mean the people I imagine I'm friends with, yes.
All right, well, you should definitely get that URL before it gets taken, because I think it's going to catch on. Speaking of things that catch on, there was a little show called The Big Bang Theory that really caught on. One of the biggest shows of all time, biggest sitcoms of all time, and had a great ensemble cast. One of them, Simon Helberg.
He was making his ACS debut, and then out of nowhere they start talking about the movie Six Pack with Kenny Rogers, and we get a whole other Kenny Rogers riff we weren't expecting on a follow-up Corolla Classics from yesterday.
Shall we bring in our guest?
I'd love
to. You have to use so many cuss words.
Yes, I fucking do. This man is one of the stars of CBS's hit series, The Big Bang Theory. And by the way, Simon Helberg, just watched an episode 2 days ago? 3 days ago.
Yeah.
Where was I?
And he was in A Serious Man. Did you see that?
Yeah. Serious Man, and I was looking at Good Night and Good Luck.
Yes.
And Old School and Van Wilder. Yes. And a black belt as well.
Yes, that is true and hard to believe.
But how did that work?
I was very little and I'm still pretty little, but I was even littler and I loved the Karate Kid, the original Karate Kid.
Sure.
When I was about 5 and a half.
How about Karate Kid 3?
How about that?
There
we are.
History's repeating itself.
Yeah.
So you were inspired by Ralph Macchio.
It's embarrassing all around.
No, it is not.
We did ask the singer of this song, how is history repeating itself in the first one?
Right. Right, yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, we got the bottom of it.
We originally intended for Rocky III.
He wrote that song for Rocky III.
I see, and then he just recycled it.
Yeah.
Well,
unless they were going to do a prequel to Karate Kid.
They couldn't get Isaac to do backup?
Wow. I'm just saying, how is history repeating itself in the first one?
Right. No, he was ambitious. He knew that he knew that there was going to be a second and a third.
So you saw that?
I saw that, and I went in. I grew up here, and I went to
Reseda.
No, that was.
Oh man, you didn't win the All Valley Tournament.
No, I was. That would have.
Where
just
did
been,
you grow up?
I grew up actually in West Hollywood.
They so. Did.
Yeah, I believe it or not, even as much as I loved Karate Kid, I did not need to go to Reseda, and I've been there since. I think I didn't.
You grew up in West Hollywood.
Yeah, I did.
And you, I didn't. Well, first off,
you didn't know there were people there.
Well, there's dads. I didn't know there were moms over there.
I had a mom and a dad, and the mom was female. And
really?
Yeah, it was for real.
What high? Did you go to a public high school?
No, I went to Crossroads.
Oh,
private
of course,
school.
Fancy.
Crossroads,
yeah, like Gwyneth Paltrow, and
she was. I think she may have gone there.
Yeah.
A lot of really cool people went there. Yeah. So
where is that?
That's in Santa Monica.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's a hip place over there.
Yeah. So
what do you learn over there? Everything.
Whatever you want to learn. And whatever grades you give yourself.
You grade yourself.
I like that.
It's your own conscience.
Because we all know that's how life works.
Yeah, yeah.
You grade yourself.
What salary do you deserve?
Whoa, a couple hundred million? I mean, before bonuses. And because when I work construction, whenever I've done roofing, I would always tell my boss, I give myself an A
there you
on
go.
This roof.
Yeah.
And you go F minus.
So you weren't bullied, because they don't have bullies, really.
Well, I mean, you know, new age, but they bully your subconscious.
Your inner child.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. My chakras were ignored.
Were you performing? Were you learning?
I was doing jazz. Then I became a musician. Then after I, because I wanted to be a karate guy. I wanted to be a martial arts actor.
Sure.
You know, very specific genre. And, you know, huge market for 5'6" Jews.
Maybe the Jew part, but the short part is
the short
good,
part's
actually.
Fine.
Yeah,
well, see, then I
came,
it all came full circle, because then I ended up becoming an actor, and the short thing is, you know, I think it's a prerequisite. To
and you're black belt, and you got a black belt when you were what age?
When I was 10.
You know, it'd be a nice, you know, I'd like to see you enter the cage with Jeff Ross.
Okay.
Oh,
Jeff Ross was the youngest black belt in, like, New Jersey.
No way.
For some time. And he got his when he was, like, 9 or 10. You know,
the guys from our karate studio, it originated in New Jersey. And I wonder if
really?
The same. Because they would come out and, like, it would be Master Dominic Giacobbe.
Right,
and
sure.
That's who would come out, like, every year. Master Dominic Giacobbe would come out and just, like, beat the shit out of, can I say shit?
Yeah, sure. Because
it's true. They were so rough on me, and my dad would have to, like, I remember my dad called one time and basically told them in one of the tests where you would, you know, move up in rank to go easy on me. Because I was, you know, I didn't see the irony of, they had to call me Mr. Helberg. I was 10.
Sure.
I was teaching classes at the age of 10, and all these Russian kids came in, and they would, you know, they would not call me Mr. Helberg. They would call me Simon, and I would get really mad, and they'd be like, what are you going to do, Simon? And then I would go and tell on them to my master.
Sure.
I'd say, Master, the Russian guys are... And they won't call me Mr. Helberg. And he was like, well, go out there and, you know, tell him to do 20 knuckle push-ups. And then I'd go out and I'd be like, Sergey, get down. And, you know, I was 4'1", maybe. And these kids were like, you know, already 5'11".
Yeah.
And they were just hysterically laughing. I wore a 000 uniform.
Really?
Because I couldn't, and they had to, like, send them in special. It was like, the irony was completely lost on me. Which it's not now.
A gi should not have a flap in the back.
No. And I could, and everyone would all, you know, I couldn't beat up anybody. I don't think I could have ever.
Well, you might be able to beat up Jeff Ross.
Well, that's only because time and donuts.
I'm just saying, if somebody said a couple of black belts are waiting out in the parking lot for you, and it was Simon and Jeff Ross, you would be fucking relieved when you walked
out
of that bar.
Yeah,
like
thank
that.
God.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I wonder, I'll have to ask Ross if...
I wonder if it's the same. Tang Soo Do.
Yeah. It's
How
good.
Many places in New Jersey could... I mean, I guess there's probably
it's
a lot.
It's good stuff, though, right? It taught you discipline and respect
and
everything, right?
In all honesty, it really actually was... It really was... I mean, it definitely... Those were the big things. To be, like, 5 and 6 and be learning about discipline and about, you know, even meditating, which I didn't even know. You know, we would do little... just things that were definitely... concentration and focus. So that was great. And then I did music, and then I came back around and took out the martial arts from my martial arts actor dreams and just went acting.
What about the music? Were you playing piano or guitar?
I played piano. I played in some jazz bands and rock bands. I played like all around when I was very young always in the things I did. I was 14 and I was playing like at the Roxy and the Whiskey and doing that rock and roll thing, and then also doing jazz at 14 with, like, braces and playing in the lobbies of hotels and getting rides from my dad, you know, which is a weird... Because the jazz scene is not usually... That's not the emblem of jazz.
Little mini rubber bands on your teeth and stuff.
It's usually, you know, heroin and, and reefer, and I was getting carpooled by my dad and playing in Westwood and, you know, again, 14 braces, white... You know, so I pushed the envelope.
Writing songs about being out of Yoo-Hoo on a 3-day weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Stuff
that's
like
the blues.
That.
Yeah. Getting my braces off is the...
Yeah, you don't know. You don't...
riff on getting your braces off. A meditation on
Wow.
Yeah, no, it was a pretty... the irony complete. I think I've led the most ironic life ever, like a hilarious life in hindsight, but really serious while it's happening.
So. Well, Big Bang Theory is going to Thursday night, right?
That is.
And basically, I was just talking to someone about this, which is they're opening up a Thursday night comedy for the, I guess, the first time in, I don't know, someone said like 25 or 30 years.
Yeah, it's, I believe it was Gilligan's Island that was really? The last show on CBS to be, I guess that was a comedy. I mean, that was considered a... I mean, I'm not trying to be...
Well, no, it had a laugh track. Yeah, so you know, it was a comedy.
I guess. It's just like a surreal... There we are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now we're a comedy, too. Yeah.
And is Big Bang... Was it... I know Two and a Half Men was sort of perennial number one, but Big Bang sort of caught up to him, maybe got past them or something?
Yes. Well, there's so many ways to
measure things, right?
Your self-worth in this city.
Yeah, because they go in the key demographic yes, right. with their thing. Yeah. The but they didn't hold as much. Yeah.
Siamese lesbians under 12 all watched from 8:42 to 9 o'clock. But then after, it's literally as specific
and
as...
And a lot of holding your lead in or gaining on it or whatever, building on a lead in and blah,
yes.
blah, blah.
But that being said, we ultimately... We were number one in the key demo, which I believe is 18.
Black men, belts.
18. Under right, that play jazz. Yeah. And the one, your co-host got an Emmy this year, right?
Yeah.
Yes, Jim Parsons, co-star. Yeah, he's fantastic. And he won Best Actor. And so we're hoping to bring our fans, I guess, over to Thursday night.
I don't see why they wouldn't go over there if they found you on a
right? You'd think. It's not, it's an honor, I guess. I grew up watching sitcoms, so Thursday, I do remember being a big night. I mean, I guess the Thursday night that was the must-see TV and Cosby
NBC,
and all that stuff.
So now, and also, you have the show, I feel like, is, well... Tell me if I'm putting words in your mouth. It expanded a little bit into a little more of an ensemble piece. Yeah. It used to just be more about Jim and his thing and living in his thing. And now you guys have been brought in and you're getting beefier storylines and things like that.
Yeah.
Which is nice. But also, I don't know if you're lazy like I am.
Well,
but
laziest black belt there ever was.
Yeah. I'm just saying. Well, I don't know about Ross, but no one's as lazy as I am. But... Is it sort of nice just being able to come in, make everyone laugh, and then leave and not going home with a huge stack of shit to memorize every night before taping?
I don't know. I can't tell which one is more self-indulgent, to wish that I had less work to do so that I could then get away with doing, nothing, or having more work so that I could be in the spotlight longer. I feel like they're both sort of...
Step up to the plate, hit a home run, then right back to the dugout. That's my feeling.
That's nice, too. I mean, I honestly enjoy... There's something I think that's harder about walking into a scene, delivering a line or two, and then leaving. I actually... Because I've had to do... the earlier part of the stuff that I had done was a lot of that, was sort of having a line here, a line there in movies or whatever. And I always found it really hard. There's no time to get into the... scene.
Yeah, you don't know what's going on.
Yeah, and you kind of, and then the pressure is, is just
so high.
You're
like a field goal kicker at that point.
Yeah, it's hard. But I love, honestly, I mean, the show is so fun, and it's been really great to flesh out the characters, because they've done a great job in terms of not making them be two-dimensional or anything.
They must be discussing doing some sort of spin-off something. I mean, with the success... that this show has had, and with the success of, as I said, some of the characters that were a little more ancillary now sort of stepping into the limelight. Mm. Has somebody discussed having you guys, I don't know, move into your own apartment and do your own whatever?
Not yet.
But it could happen.
It could
be a Jeffersons on our horizon here.
Right. You could see something like that, I guess. It hasn't been discussed.
Well, not with you.
Not with me.
But I'll bet you it's been discussed.
Right.
I know TV people.
Yeah, well, look at all this. Has there been a successful spinoff recently? Frasier, I guess, was the last.
Yeah, I'm trying to think.
Practice, the what's it called?
Oh, yeah, right.
Private Practice. Yeah, aren't, I mean, how would I know? I'm not gay.
NCIS and Law and Order, aren't those all
Yeah, but those are like the same.
Those are kind of franchises.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Don't give this super condescending.
But I mean, I'm thinking, like, was it like Happy? There was like the whole Happy Days.
Oh, sure.
Laverne and Shirley. Mork and Mindy.
Mork and Mindy. And there's Joni Loves Chachi.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
And there was Ralph Mouth and his blow dryer, which came later. Yeah, first one's puffy hair. Hey, T-Bone, now, should we do, you want to finish some of the news? Would you like to try to read this Alec Baldwin email?
Let's go over this email.
All right. A week or so ago, Simon, we were talking that the thing about emails is it's difficult to get people's sort of inflection and intent.
Right.
And I'm not sure if people are being sarcastic or they think I'm being sarcastic. It's a lot.
You've probably been misunderstood.
A lot lost in the translation, right?
I agree.
Mm-hmm. All right. So here's the email that I asked Alec Baldwin to write a blurb for a book that I have coming out on November 2nd. And he wrote a very nice blurb. It was, you know, well thought out. It's just what you'd expect a guy like Baldwin to do.
Right.
Took a couple of minutes. Wrote something nice. It was very smart, very interesting. And then I wrote him back. Let's see. Alec, thank you for going above and beyond for the blurb for my book. It would have been easy to write just a quick joke, but you obviously put a lot of thought into it, and I really appreciate that.
Yes.
Signed, me. And then I get an email back from Alec that says, are you pulling my leg? Question mark. Would you prefer a longer, more formal piece of writing?
Right.
Now,
so he took the read sarcasm, like 100% sarcasm. Into you.
Right.
He went, oh, thanks.
Probably
for, like,
because
thanks for the blurb.
Yes.
Really well
thanks for
thought
not writing
out.
He didn't think it was earnest because he knows, like, sarcastic Adam.
So he saw quotes around everything.
When I said it would have been easy just to write a quick joke, but you obviously put a lot of thought into it. He heard
you
obviously got your assistant when she was drunk to put a lot of thought into your shitty blurb.
Yeah, right.
So you can't say you obviously because that you can't use words like obviously,
so careful.
Any hyperbole is also very, you know, you start to sound sarcastic.
Yeah, you can't say you're the smartest guy.
You're the greatest guy out
there. Right, because get it. Oh, you think I'm a dunce.
Good for you.
Good for you.
Everything's Christian Bale.
Good for you.
So then I said I really appreciate that. And then I realized, oh, he thought I was being snarky in my email. Oh, by the way, how big a dick would I have to be? Yeah. Like, hey, Baldwin, you only did a paragraph on my shitty book? Yeah. Come on, buddy.
Yeah.
Can't a little take a couple minutes for that piece of shit 30
sense,
rock?
You get the sense he's been burned a few times, and so he's ready to see the worst.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then I said, I'll be in New York for the first week of November with the book release. Let me know if you're going to be in town. I'd love to buy you a drink. So obviously, I'm not going snarky because you can't.
You could read snarky. If he's that, maybe he's just, there's a chip missing. And
everything's
really
yellow
sees
to the jaundiced eye.
Yeah.
Well, I did not make that up. It's a quote.
That's good.
That's a dark metaphor.
But it's true.
I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah, so...
the world is jaundiced.
I just wrote back. Now, this is another thing, which is now you're in danger of going too far and overcompensating the other.
I loved your blurb.
Now you're trouble again?
Yeah.
So I just wrote back, I just wanted to thank you for a great job, and that's all I wrote. That I don't know.
Uh-oh.
Now I don't know if that one got snarkified.
Right, because
now put in the snarkulator.
You can do that.
I got put in the snark tumbler.
Yeah, because that one, the first one, was maybe a few overly effusive that read sarcastic, and this one was overly
curt.
Laconic.
Laconic.
Shit. So now what?
So
I gotta call him.
You're gonna have to call him because you know what?
But isn't it sad that's the last thing that you would ever do is talk to somebody?
Well, to be
human interaction.
To be fair to him or me or somebody, it's hard to, you know,
reach him.
It's kind of hard to get hold of him.
No, I understand that.
But I just want to say thanks.
You know what? Next time, can I say muffin basket?
Muffin basket?
Yeah. You all just send a gift.
But if they're Disney? Little...
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, but they have to be a specific... Because if they're mini muffins... Then
that can
be
taken
like,
along.
Oh,
the
right. I see. Oh.
Mini muffins.
You think I'm a mini talent, yeah. dude?
Right, that's what you're
oh,
saying.
I get it. I'm fat. Yeah. And you don't want me to carb load with yeah. regular size muffins. Okay. So I'm a bloated mini
I'm
talent.
I'm the fat Baldwin, aren't I? Oh. That's what. Okay.
Oh, in a basket. So I'm like a basket case?
Oh, and you know what? I called my daughter a piggy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I should give these to my daughter?
Yeah. I should force it on my piggy daughter.
Yeah.
Okay.
The most defensive man on the planet.
I think maybe you're right.
Who knew?
The good news is you're fired.
Maybe he was fucking around with this and I'm being overly
right.
sensitive.
Yeah, I can't tell.
He's like, oh, I'm going to make Adam go crazy.
Wow, we're going to have to work this out.
Well, we worked it out between Dag and Dr. Drew.
Yeah.
We had a similar exchange that went sour.
All right. Should we do a little rich man, poor man?
Yeah. Let's
try some of that. Simon doesn't
Jeremiah
know
Jeremiah Weed presents Rich Man, Poor Man.
Yeah, that's one of our new sponsors, Jeremiah Weed. They make a tasty, tasty beverage. These are the things, Simon, that rich people and poor people share, but the middle class does not. And,
okay.
The genesis of this was I was sitting around one day, and I thought, outdoor showers. I thought that's either you're super rich or poor. But middle class people that drive, you know, tourist wagons and live in three bedroom homes in Sherman Oaks or North Hollywood don't have an outdoor shower. So these are and then almost everything outdoors, like a refrigerator outdoor.
That's true.
That's either by the tennis courts or in the front yard.
Even a mini fridge too. Like some for real poor people
that's
a fridge.
That's their fridge.
Right.
Right. All right, shall we...
want to hear some nominees?
Yeah, let's hear a few.
Oh, I got one. This one was tweeted to me. A judge knows you really well, or you have history with a judge.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, yeah.
You're either a repeat offender or you're like an influential lawyer.
I like
lawyer.
That. Mm-hmm. I must say, I've noticed this walking around my neighborhood, and I thought, rich man, poor man, because I live in a very poor neighborhood, and there are quite a few travel agencies, and I thought, who's still using travel agents?
Right.
Really rich people planning safaris?
Right.
Or really poor people who need to... visit back home.
That's true.
And don't have the internet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got handmade shoes. Either you literally just made your shoes yourself.
Depends whose hands they are.
Right. Or you got some Bruno Mali's or something, some one-offs. Let's see. I don't know.
Oh, wait. Ray was just in here that reminded me. Remember, He didn't have a credit card, so to set up his phone, his name would pop up as someone else's ID because that's who would have set up his phone account for him.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
That versus, like, your assistant sets it up for you. Because it used to be when you called, it would say, like, Jay.
Right.
So assistant sets it up for you versus someone with a credit card
Accounts
sets it up
not
for
under
you.
Your own name.
It is one of these. It is one of these things where, you're a loser. Like, when Ray, his thing will say Don Chandler on it, and if I see Don Chandler, I know that's my buddy Ray because he's a loser.
Yeah.
And then I love when a loser gives a loser excuse where I was like, Ray, what's up with this or that? Oh, I said, I needed Ray to go reserve something at a tool rental place for me. The man was 46 years old at the time, and he's like, I don't have a credit card. And I'm like, you don't have a credit. You're 46, right? Do you think it's time to get yourself a credit card? And then he did this one. My mom died, and she was a co-signer, okay? Oh. And you're like, well, bigger loser? Like, you know, there's a thing where people make the excuse where they're like, it sounds like something good's going to come out, and then it's like, why is your mom co-signing for your...
In
your 40s. Right, for your thing. All right, we have a few people on the line we can try out here. Hey, Dominic.
Yeah, Adam.
What's going on, Dominic?
How you doing?
Doing well. Thank you, buddy.
I've got a couple, but I think the best one is inbreeding.
Yeah.
That's excellent.
That is. Like the Royals. Bloods, a lot of Royals.
I'm sure there are hemophiliacs and such.
Yeah, and then you got your sort of Hatfields and McCoy.
The mountain people.
Yeah, the
Very
mountain
good.
People.
Strong.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice job. What are you doing over there in San Diego, Dominic?
I'm at work, actually.
Yeah, we're coming out there for the Coronado Vintage Race.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, soon. Where do you work?
Yeah, I work up in North County, San Diego. I do marketing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like he's probably not supposed to be on this call.
Yeah.
Probably not.
All right, but thank you for taking the time to play the very important Rich Man, Poor Man game with us. Thanks, buddy.
All right, thanks.
That is one of those things I don't miss about having a job, is that I could get in trouble for whatever I'm doing, so I'm going to do it fast for my cubicle thing. Yeah. That weird, whether it was shoving a bunch of Filet-O-Fish in my mouth by the dumpster when I worked at the McDonald's, or, you know, taking a piss and on the construction site or drinking out of the hose, that sort of I'm looking over my shoulder sort of thing. That's sad, isn't it, when you can't make a goddamn call from your cubicle because the man's going to be up your ass?
Yeah.
Let's talk to Ernie. Ernie?
Yeah, I'm here.
You're 32 years of age?
Yes, I am.
Congratulations on being the youngest Ernie in North America. There must be an Ernie story. Dad's an Ernie. Grandpa's an Ernie.
My dad's an Ernie, yeah.
Yeah. No one just says, hey, my name's Bob, and that's my wife, Shelly, and we're going to name this one Ernie.
Yeah.
No one ever does that.
Well, they haven't for about 60
years. What's your wife's name?
Her name's Rhonda.
Rhonda. Yeah, that's
kind of an old-fashioned name.
Yeah.
I like that name.
Yeah, but it's like Ernie and Rhonda, you'd meet over at the Denny's for the early bird supper. You got half off
maybe
at 5 p.m.
Maybe she's in her 70s. You don't know.
Yeah.
Ernie's
what do you got in rich man, poor man?
I was going to say race car driving.
Mmm. You're talking like sort of F1 or the sort of Arthur sort of thing where you just go out in the track. You're a rich guy. You get track time driving your Carrera GT Porsche versus your sort of Brewster Baker sort of dirt track oval. Hey, Brewster Baker, six pack. Come on, Kenny Rogers' greatest role since The Gambler.
Right.
Oh, come on,
you know
Kenny Rogers.
I it's ringing a bell, but I wouldn't be able to pull that out of
The Coward of the County?
Better than Coward of the County.
What?
There it is, six pack.
I don't know about Ernie digging deep at the race car driving.
No. There's a. Think about all the guys that would be out in, you know, Fontana on a Saturday night. I mean, think about the dirt,
fans
like drag racing,
the dirt. I don't mean big time.
No,
I mean the oval, the dirt track, the figure eight.
Right, like in your Festiva.
I would think like attending an event would be rich man, poor man, because either you're going to one of these fancy things you go to, or you're going to like a NASCAR.
Well, it's true that you could go to the Grand Prix in Monaco, and that'd be a super rich guy thing to do. Or you could go down to Talladega, and that'd be sort of
give
a white trash note.
Woo!
That'd be that'd be a poor man. But even like I said, even driving, you guys, come on, there's six.
That's a movie.
That's a movie.
There's no denying that.
Yeah.
Smart move on Kenny.
No,
Park.
Coen
never,
Brothers
never
movie like you've been in.
Well, that's, yeah.
It's got, had to be confusing. Thank you, Ernie.
Thank you.
I like, by the way, when, as it's gone on my entire career, especially on Loveline, where I go, Ernie, that's a strange name for a 32-year-old. You must have a dad named Ernie. Yeah, my dad's named Ernie. Anyway, could even get a, hey, not bad.
Yeah, that's
good guess.
Right.
I just called your dad's name out.
Yeah, it's pretty. I mean,
I didn't ask you anything, and I just named your dad. You want to give me a little something?
Yeah, no.
No love? Yeah, that's my dad's name. You know why? It's kind of, when you're dumb, it's a kind of narcissism where you think people know shit.
Yeah.
Like when my kids come home and they go, Billy said, Billy, and you go like, who's Billy?
Then
I'll go, one of the children from my class I attend the school
his name's
with.
Billy.
But they think you know. It's a narcissistic thing.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
If they know, you must know.
Well, his dad's name is Ernie. Yeah, my dad's name's Ernie. Yeah, what of it?
He didn't have...
I've known that for 30 years.
For that.
No.
That could be like a carnival
I didn't get a
trick.
Fucking...
Yeah, it's true.
I didn't get
He has a lot of carnival tricks
I mean, that you could be paid just for that.
Not one decibel louder did I get with that.
No, I was impressed. About 20 times in a row, a caller to our radio show would laugh, and by the sound of their laugh, Adam could correctly predict whether or not they smoked pot. Never wrong.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the answer to me asking if they smoked a lot of pot would be more laughing.
Right. Which that's an easy yes. Yeah.
Must have been confusing for Kenny Rogers when his agent called him in, 1986 and said, we want you to play Brewster Baker, a NASCAR driver, has to raise a bunch of orphans on the road. And he went, I don't remember writing a song about that.
Yeah.
No, that's just a role.
Yeah.
Right. But I must have written about it, like The Gambler, or Coward of the County. No. Kenny, you don't understand. Marlon Brando didn't write a song called On the Waterfront. They just cast him.
His
world's like, so they want me to write a song about it so we can make it into a movie?
Like, no song.
No song. You just go out. Just
wait.
Although, this is the song. Starkey's living and giving.
I actually but I'll like bet the premise for this movie. I feel like I want to see it.
Yeah. But he wrote this after the song. He had to do it.
Does he learn a lot about himself because he has to raise all these orphans and not be so self-centered?
I'm going
to
write a song about an angry man who hooks up with a bunch of orphans and learns nothing about himself. Learns that he hates kids. And that he feels a certain sexual charge when he's
with
around
a couple
them.
Of them.
Sure. Like three of them.
It's a hit!
Woody Allen could direct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe it was the maybe it was his. Maybe he called his agent. He was like, "Do you have anything with orphans and race cars? Is there any way to bring my?"
Or maybe like his agent called and went, "Good news, Kenny. Pacino just turned down the role of Brewster Baker, the NASCAR driver."
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I recommend a six pack highly. Highly.
Clearly. I'm. What year is it from? 80s?
I would say somewhere around the time. You were influenced by the wrong movie, my friend.
No, I know. Yeah. I could have been.
You could be on the
driver.
Circuit right now.
I could have
now.
Eight kids and.
And by the way, isn't being a smaller guy better for being a driver?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Unsprung weight. Mm-hmm. All right. That about. Do we have an outro, by the way, for Rich Man, Poor Man?
Whether you're a rich man or a poor man, you'll love Jeremiah Weed.
Thank you. All right. Should we do the rest of the news, T-Bone?
Sure.
Simon, you just
and
hang
now,
out and chime in.
The rest of the news with Teresa Strasser.
And that was Simon Helberg breaking down some Kenny Rogers with Adam. A little Rich Man, Poor Man in there for you, too.
Yep, they did some Rich Man, Poor Man before the six-pack breakdown. I wanted to leave a surprise.
Yeah. Rich Man, Poor Man's really making a comeback in Adam's life. He is doing that a lot more now, which I love. Because
Seinfeld was right. It's a genius bit, and it's one of these things that it's a smarter version. You might be a redneck.
Yeah.
It's one of these things that's universally true where you're like, oh, I do put a TV on top of a TV.
And for those who want to see some more Rich Man, Poor Man, there's a coffee table book with featuring illustrations by Michael Narron available. So just Google that, Rich Man, Poor Man, Adam Carolla, and you can find it for sale. Digital coffee table book, yeah. Keep your iPad on your coffee table and have people swipe through it. Gio, I'm really excited for this next clip because it features a guy who we talk about all the time. Baby Doll, James Dixon. Very rarely does he come on air.
Never heard of him.
It's Adam's agent.
He's a cultural icon at this point. He was on The State, essentially. He's portrayed as himself on The State. Like, Baby Doll was on there. Like, it's a bit.
Tom Lennon.
Tom Lennon, of course, did that. It's, you know, Adam's made fun of him. All of his clients talk about him the same way. If you're remotely connected to comedy or Hollywood, you probably know somebody who does a James Baby Doll Dixon impression.
Yeah. But here's him on air doing the real deal back in 2013. He shares some classic stories with Sal.
And they go over how Adam and Sal first met when Adam came to town with Jimmy and the kind of chaos that went down. And they go over the peanut butter at KLSX controversy with Baby Doll, who was willing to pay the $5 for peanut butter.
Check Adam's voicemail, brought to you by eVoice. eVoice, the reason you'll make more money in 2013.
Hey, Adam, it's Daniel. I just want to say I think the best idea for a movie sequel to The Hammer is called Hammer 2, Hammer in the Slammer. Somehow you got arrested for what you did or what you were doing, and you have to box in jail. So, take that, make $1 million. Talk to you later. Bye.
For a free 6-month trial, click the eVoice banner on adamcarolla.com or go to eVoice.com and use the promo code Adam.
It'll cost $3 million to make, and then I'll make that $1 million, and then we'll all be fucked. Sal, Cousin Sal Iacono in studio. James Baby Doll Dixon, our agent, is here as well. Let's see. So many. Where to begin? Sal, by the way, is here for FightClub.com March Madness Fantasy Competition. It's interesting. I was talking to Gary Haftard about it on the phone, but you explain how this works.
Well, here it is. I mean, I know you don't like fantasy sports in general, right? You call it what do you call it?
Fairy tale football.
Fairy
it's
tale
more
football.
Demeaning. Yeah.
But there are some good things about it, and the best thing about Fight Club is it's one day and you're out, and then you start over the next day, or if you want, or you don't. You don't have to deal with the season long keeping up with injuries, having some knucklehead friend try to trade, rip you off in a trade 5-for-1. It's you against a stranger. You put anywhere from $2 to $500 up. You pick your five best players that are on the court that day, and he'll pick his five best, and then whoever wins, and it's great. It's the purest form of fantasy, and it's totally legal.
Now, the first time I met Cousin Sal, he picked me up in his mom's car from the airport and couldn't find his way from the airport back to his house. True or false?
You know, we were talking about this just yesterday, Jimmy and I were, and the worst part is you were coming off like a 10-hour flight, right? Was it Tower Air?
Well, we flew – all right, K-Rock, because it's radio, yeah, flew us Tower Air, which is such a fine airline, it doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. It didn't have its own terminal, so you had to take a bus that was pulled by a donkey. It didn't even have an engine in it. And you'd get out of the bus, and you'd get actually, if we just stayed on the bus and went to New York, it would have only taken about a half hour longer.
Right.
I did the math. So – And, you know, of course, traveling with Jimmy, we had to get there 3 days before fucking flight. So I was like 31 and never been on an airplane before because I'm a Corolla. So I was sort of nervous about flying. Jimmy and I got there like 2 hours early, and then we sat on the bus, and then we sat on the plane. And what Tower Air's business model was, they would take 747s and gut them and just put lawn furniture. No, they would just put – everything was coach. And I remember just going – I remember thinking while we were sitting there, I thought, this is a 747 with like 585 people on it. And yeah. I thought, if this plane crashes, it will be the greatest air disaster ever because you've never seen this many people on one plane.
That's what you're thinking on your first flight?
That's my first flight. And then secondly, like the bathrooms would just start overflowing because there was like – it's not meant to have 500 people. People on
how,
a plane.
What do you mean? It's 3 by 3 by 3. How big?
They gut. What they would do is they would just take the whole first class and business class out completely, right, and then fill them with coach size seats. So instead of a 747 carrying 320 people, they'd get like another 150 people on this plane. And it was horrible. And of course, the people were worse than the plane. Yeah. And I didn't even have earbuds or Sports Illustrated. I just came prepared to sit and talk Jimmy's ear off. But our journey was about 10 hours long because the flight was 6+, the bus ride, the wait, and everything else.
Well, it's also – I'm sorry to cut you off – one of those airlines where they don't have clearance to land, right? Doesn't everyone else have to land before them? And then if there's a hiccup, then get in.
Sometimes they never land.
Yeah.
We were
praying for a bird strike so we could put it down in the Hudson at a certain point. So finally we land, and here comes Cousin Sal and his mom, station wagon or whatever he's driving, to come pick us up. And I'm like, this odyssey's over for me. I want to get to Cousin Sal's house and crash. And Cousin Sal couldn't find his way from the airport back to the house he grew up in.
Do you have a terrible sense of direction?
Yeah, it was pretty bad back then. Yeah. But I will say half the – I figured out how to get – I love the story more than anything. So I'm like, wow, if I could prolong their agony, put the windows up and fart.
There was a lot of farting.
Add another 45 hour to this.
And then when I went to Cousin Sal's house, we were in Long Island. Where were we?
Yep.
I went to the auxiliary room bed, sort of the laundry room bed. It was a bed – but it was more of a platform for – like a hamper platform. Like if you were putting dirty clothes on display, like if you were – there's a museum for filthy clothes. That's what it would – they would use that as a pedestal. So it all gathered. So I had to move all of the dirty clothes, but there was a lot of sand on the bed because evidently some of those clothes have been worn to the beach.
And then
I just covered myself in blankets and dirty clothes and went to bed. And at some point, Sal's crazy mom dove on me. The following morning, she literally dove on me. Jimmy! It was out of a sitcom. I had the blanket and everything over my head. She just dove on top of me.
But then she broke your glasses. So you take the good with the bad.
She broke my glasses. I kept them because I was still going to just do the one arm move, and then at some point she threw it away.
She broke them from diving on you?
I don't know if she squeezed something out of me, but the glasses broke and she threw them away.
Right.
And that's all I remember. Then the next time I slept over, your buddy Cow molested me in my sleep. I don't know how to explain Cow.
It's tough.
It's tough to explain, but it was another one of those. I went to bed at 3, and at 6:30 in the morning, he was doing this Gucci Gucci Goo thing on my feet. And, you know, I'm not what you call uptight, but I was like, I don't know you at all. So this is very strange and somewhat homoerotic.
I went to college upstate New York, a place called Oswego, and there was a power plant right there, a nuclear power plant. And Cow grew up like right underneath the power plant. And back then, it was so inbred anyway.
He didn't go to school there.
No.
don't think for a second he went to school
Not
there.
A lick of school. But he would they would call them IBS. Short for incest babies, and Cal was just about—he was an ib, and he had many extra chromosomes, and he would like tickling people's feet in the morning.
But thank,
and that was
thank goodness that he was heavily into gambling, because the only way out of that life is through heavy gambling.
Yeah.
And
IBS make good.
He'd do a weird Gucci Gucci Goo thing, and then do a sort of a Fred Flintstone before he bowled. That kind of move, where he twinkle toes kind of move. I was like, it was 6 in the morning. He said, Gucci, Gucci, Goo. And I was, and then he'd do this sort of backhand cheek drag thing. And I was like, it was like the guy from The Hills Have Eyes came down to fuck with you while you're trying to sleep.
It was scary.
It was weird. I think I was maybe in your sister's room or something at that point. My feet were hanging, you know, 9 inches out of the end of the bed. And he found me and decided it was time to roust this guy he didn't know.
Right.
He accused you of having a prank on you, or is that just how he shows that he's interested in playing?
His head's not straight. He was accusing you of having a sleeping disorder. You had slept for like 4 hours.
Yeah, he was the world's worst drill sergeant. So it was also the guy, and so he didn't feel comfortable in New York.
Yeah.
He was from the sticks, you know.
And Cow?
Cow. Cow needed to be in a pasture somewhere fishing. Or playing three-card Monty, but he did not like being in the city. It kind of freaked him freaked him out in a little kind of a Rain Man kind of way, you know? And it was kind of like Shrek meets Rain Man. Picture big gargantuan guy meets Rain Man.
You're being nice, but
So Sal was there. Me and Jimmy were there. We're in New York. Rain Shrek. And I was there, and I didn't have anything to do. Jimmy had to do the sports because Kevin and Bean were in town, and we're doing the thing. We used to come in town once a year for the MTV Music Awards. And so I was dispatched to go down to whatever station, Penn Station, and pick him up at Charlie O's. And this story contains almost everything I love about life, which is I was told, look, he's going to be at Charlie O's at 11 a.m., and he's coming in from Oswego, and he's going to be freaked out. Mm-hmm. And if you don't find him, like, he's literally going to have a panic attack or something. So you make sure you're at Charlie O's at 5 minutes to 11. His train comes in right at 11. He's going straight to Charlie O's. You'll grab him, collect him, and bring him back to the radio station. I said, I'll be there. So I go down to Penn Station, and I'm standing at Charlie O's up on the ground floor there. There's Charlie O's, and I'm just standing there. And eventually I say to a cop and like a security guy, I'm supposed to meet a guy here at Charlie O's. And someone who worked there, I said, I'm supposed to meet someone here. Have you seen a guy who's built like sort of if the Incredible Hulk had a learning disability and just a little Asperger's, like, but he dressed the same, you know? Like, I'm looking for that guy. And there's like, nobody like that here. And I even said, is there another Charlie O's somewhere or something? No, this is it. And I was like, well, all right. And an hour went by, and I started to freak out because Sal's marching orders were, if you don't find this guy, he may go on.
No one will.
Yeah. No one will. Yeah. Like, he's going to freak out and throw himself on the tracks. And I went down to the basement. I found the Port Authority office. I went in. I said, it was out of a movie. I said, listen, I'm looking for a guy. You guys have to put an APB out on a guy because he's freaked out and he's walking around and they go, well, give us a description of the guy. And I was like, He looks like a manatee with a gambling problem. And I looked up and I saw him walking. And I said, he looks like, it was like a sitcom. I said, him. And I went, forget it. I got it. And I ran over. There's another Charlie O's in the basement. There's two Charlie O's.
That's poor planning.
I know, that's but terrible. Why doesn't the one person who works at the Charlie O's, that's somewhere around the fifth time I go, I'm supposed to meet a guy here at the Charlie O's.
You think it would happen to them every minute of every day.
Right, yeah.
Why are you playing so close to the vest with your Charlie O placement? Like, what are the chances? I may go down to your other franchise and buy a Blooming Onion or something down there. Like, why don't you just tell me there's another Charlie O's? I'm like, I'm supposed to meet a guy. Are you sure you've not said? I told him Charlie O's Penn Station. And like the cop's like, I don't know. What can I do? I was like, what the fuck wouldn't you share that information?
Right.
Yeah, ask all right. Questions.
So Cousin Sal also, well, a lot of good stuff. He gave Jeff Ross a good story. Would you like to get into the Jeff Ross story?
Oh, yeah.
The Dancing with the Stars?
People say you're to blame for that escalating to another level. But
really?
Yeah, because it happened on your show where he really got mad at me. But I guess he was mad at me. But all right, so Jeff Ross is on Dancing with the Stars, and he's on for 1 week, and he has the lowest combined score from the three judges ever in the history of the show. But he thinks he's the greatest. And on top of all this, he gets poked in the eye to the point where he has to go out and do his last show with an eye patch on. And it's just a joke from the beginning. So
he's fallen in love with his partner, too.
Yeah, who was it? Edita, right?
Edita.
Yeah.
Edita.
Mm-hmm.
She was nice. But she has the lowest score, and now's the toss-off night.
Mm-hmm.
And I send him – because here's the thing. On Jimmy Kimmel Live, we have the person voted off on the show immediately after Dancing with the Stars. So I text Jeff saying, you're safe. And I don't know that he's safe. I think he's probably going to get voted off with the lowest combined score ever in the history of the show. And he's like, are you sure? And I write, yes. I've even taking a picture of it. So he goes and tells editor, we're safe. We're doing good. So now they build the drama. They have it down to him. The bottom two, it's Jeff and Kim Kardashian.
And you don't – when you're standing up there, you really have no idea whether you won or lost or getting kicked off. They won't tell you anything. And there's no like, everyone knows before the show. It's not one of those –
you can't feel that you bombed.
Not one of those. It doesn't matter how badly you bombed. Whoever's standing next to you bombed too, because they wouldn't be with you that early on. And it's not all based on who got the scores or whatever. So when you get a word like this, you're probably feeling pretty good about yourself.
Yeah.
It was fun to watch his face change.
Right, and it shows. It shows on TV. Like, he couldn't have been happier to be in the bottom two. And he's like, he's even nudging his partner. He's like, we're good. Don't worry. We're good. We're good. And then leaving us this week, Jeff and Edita. And like you said, his face just drops and he has nothing. I mean, that's the thing with Jeff. If he knew he was getting voted off, he would have 40 hacky lines prepared. And he had nothing but a stunned face, and the credits are rolling. And that's the end of Jeff. So, and then I text him back. I'm like, sorry, dude, I fucked up.
But Jeff, so then, Jeff's he's way more sensitive than the roast master should ever be, right? Like, it's a weird inverse thing.
His personality when he comes in here, he seems like a really sweet, soft-spoken guy.
Mm-hmm. Super sweet and super thin-skinned, and he was upset at Cousin Sal.
Very upset, and he said the difference, because we pointed that out. Like, you're the roast master general. Can't you take a joke? And he's like, we're supposed to be friends. That's outside the code, and this, and I violated this code and that one. So we go on Adam's show. We call in. You had us call in.
Right.
And I think you posed a question to me, like, all right, are you sorry? Would you ever do it again, given the chance? And I wasn't going to be like these guys who apologize just to apologize. Like, yeah, I think I would do it again. It was pretty funny, right?
And we got a good story out of it. Yeah. And by the way, you didn't prevent him or encourage him to get tossed off.
Right.
He was going one way or the other. I mean, there's a certain bottom line here, which is he was leaving that night, whether you told him he was leaving or not.
Oh, in his head, he had changed it like that. I got him voted off.
Right.
He was going to win the glitter ball if it weren't for me.
Is he still mad?
It's called the Outland.
Well,
but anyway,
yeah. So then, months later, we've had a football Sunday at Jimmy's. He cooks and everything. Cooks up a storm. Dawson used to be invited to that, but then
That was a wildly uncomfortable moment. It was Jimmy.
That was wildly uncomfortable.
Kicked Dawson. He banned him from coming to the football.
I thought it was a joke.
Well, that's where it got really uncomfortable, because then when the mics got cold, he said, all right, but Jimmy, that was just for the radio. And Jimmy said, no. And then that's for real. And I was like, wow, this is horrible.
I emailed Jimmy and said, so I'll see you Sunday, right? Just, you've seen some of the horrible emails that comes out of that man.
Oh, yeah.
He tore me apart.
What did he say?
What was the rationale?
I know what the rationale for him getting rid of me was. It wasn't my scene.
Well, your Chargers were on a bye week, and you wanted to know why they weren't on.
Well, that was what was called. But, you know, if he really wanted to clean the herd, I was definitely in the top 1% of the people who needed to get the fuck out of there.
You don't think it was because of the cheese?
The cheese, again, is a pizza cheese that is standard across the fucking nation. They use
Explain
Monterey
the cheese
Jack.
Backstory.
He put the wrong cheese in a calzone, and that was
Don't like ricotta.
Okay.
That's what I said.
Well, tell that to your 13-inch black and white Zenith.
Every Sunday.
Every Sunday.
Alone.
Just you and your fish. So he didn't know his team was on a bye week.
Unacceptable.
He was unacceptable. Yeah. He put the wrong cheese in a calzone. And he was basically in a Jeff
there
Ross
was something else. Yeah,
situation with Dancing with the Stars already. He was on the way out anyway, and this just hurried him. This ushered him out a little faster.
You also claimed you make the best chili or something, or the stew, but you had to bring four guys to do it?
No. Those were other friends of mine from Boston.
Yeah, right. But you said, I'm going to make this for you, but I need these guys.
I offered.
Don't argue with Jimmy about chili. Yeah.
It wasn't chili. It was Boston clam chowder.
Oh, down Austin. Like.
No, yeah. Don't get in a fight.
Anyway, who's more of a prankster, Sal, you or Jimmy?
I think Jimmy likes it more. I don't know.
Jimmy likes it more, but Sal has become sort of his henchman. Like, Sal maybe does a little of his bidding. Yeah, you know, Jimmy's pretty busy now.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Sal tortures Baby Doll. Mm-hmm. Jimmy, well, give some of the. What was when you ordered, Neptune's pyramid of seafood?
Yeah.
One, and was there a Jason Sudeikis one there? I can't remember.
Yeah,
who was telling
a good
me
one.
About why what line he said that
Jason
made me laugh.
Jason Sudeikis. I would order. See, the great thing about Baby Doll, which we don't get anymore, is he would take he would pay for all the meals. It was understood in the beginning of the meal. He's going to pay. But he's also taking smoke breaks, 6-10 smoke breaks throughout the meal. So you can get the waiter's ear and say, hey, we're going to order more of this. And he's only there half the time to say, bullshit, we're not getting another fucking seafood tower. So I ended up ordering 3 seafood towers. I don't even remember where it was. The Sunset Plaza.
That was at Sunset.
Yeah.
Jason
Sudeikis comes over.
A really expensive restaurant. They were about, what, $80 per tower,
it was a
I
lot.
Think. Yeah.
And Jason Sudeikis comes by our table. He's like, Jesus Christ, even Al Qaeda knew to stop at 2 towers.
Wow.
But he doesn't smoke anymore, so it's going to be tough to slip these in.
And
I'll smoke my electronics outside.
I was talking about cleaning out his mini barn, chucking it out the window.
Oh, God.
Sounded like fun. I'm trying to think. Did you chuck his cell phone out of the convertible?
What happened? We were late to San Diego. I forgot there was some story.
We were driving
to San Diego.
I was trying to
get
directions.
You're trying to get directions. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's when Sal chucked. Yeah, I was trying to get directions, and he chucked the
He's screaming at the concierge and then apologizing, screaming at me, apologizing to the concierge.
That was a wild ride. Yeah.
Do you have any? And Sal was kind of the curator over at the Man Show. He took a lot of the pictures. He remembers all the good stories. Me peeing in the coffee pot, but that was only in retribution to you guys shitting up the bathroom all the time. Any Man Show stories come to mind?
We would pee that bathroom. That was disgusting. I mean, it would be like a rainforest after a while. The piss would come from the ceilings.
It was horrible.
We didn't even care. But I'm trying to think.
Did you even try to get it in the toilet?
No, after a while, it was like it was shameful to get any in the
toilet. Sal and a gentleman by the name of Brad would just shit it up royally. And that's my whole shitting at the workplace policy. Just get on.
Yeah.
I give my employees 2 weeks to get their system online, and then
they shit at home and then they come into work. Why are you coming? There's a lot of people coming to work and take a shit.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's the weirdest thing. Mm-hmm. By the way, I think there's not a boss in the land that if you said, look, we're going to strike a deal. I either show up at 9 loaded for bear with a cup of coffee in my hand, or I show up at 9:20 shitless.
Yeah.
Now, what's it going to be? I think every boss in America would be, let's call it 9:30 and play it safe, right?
Right.
Maybe Matt, the porcelain punisher fondelier, is doing that. Let's play Sal, his song. Do you have Matt's?
What is it?
Matt does nothing but shit. It's like I literally pay him to shit. Like that, I don't even know what he does.
What's he eating?
What isn't he eating?
He has a nervous stomach.
He never stops shitting. And I know he never stops shitting because I have everybody trained over here, which is door shut, someone's in the bathroom. Door open, come on in. Mm. Door ajar, enter at your own risk.
You know who always fucks this up?
Mm.
The female companion of guests.
Yeah,
and I always know that I can smell the perfume when I'm trying to figure out if someone's in the bathroom.
They don't know the protocol. Oh, they don't know the ass protocol. But every time I show up at the shop, the door's open 7 inches and the fart fan's going, and that means Matt was in there. I'm like, how often can you shit in one workday? But let's hear the song anyway. I think you guys will probably enjoy this Rich Banks number.
Someone's in the bathroom. Can only be one man. He's the one who's always in there, demolishing the can. Pants around his ankles, stinking up the place. Buys his TP at Costco, needs it by the case. Finally, he's in there shitting up the commode. He's in there shitting.
Nice.
He's in there shitting up the commode.
Great, Dick Banks. All right.
You took one of the worst songs of the last 50 years and made it likable.
Made it one of the greatest songs ever.
Yeah. It looks like Matt wants to say something.
Matt.
Oh, I got nothing to say. I'm just glad to be part of the team.
Yeah. Speaking of team, how about go to meeting? How about you get the team together, but you don't sit in the same room and you don't share the same bathroom. You do it in HD. You do it with go to meeting with HD faces. Brought to you by Citrix. You can share documents and spreadsheets. You can collaborate in HD video. You can launch, host, or attend meetings from any Mac, any PC, iPhone, iPad, whatever you like. And we got a contest. You can win yourself an iPad, a brand new iPad. Just tell us on Twitter where you'd like to host your meeting from and use the hashtag AdamFreeiPad and you get a chance to win yourself a brand new iPad. Thanks to our good friends over at GoToMeeting. We'll announce the winner April 3rd, so start hosting face-to-face meetings today. GoToMeeting. Try it out for free. 30 days free. Just go to GoToMeeting.com. Click on the Try It Free button and use the promo code Adam. Yes, Brian.
As long as Dixon's making a rare in-studio appearance, can I get him to corroborate a story about having a phone conversation with Jack Silver about the possibility of peanut butter in the studio?
When we started, yes. Baby Doll is not a radio. He's not a radio agent. He's a television theatrical. He's a super agent, but he doesn't slum it in radio. But he had to with me, and I said to him, "Be careful, Baby Doll. I mean, just." Be forewarned going into this. This is not Jon Stewart and Comedy Central. This is a different breed, and they don't treat talent like talent.
You did warn me. Although we were hardly slumming it on that deal.
No, it was a great deal, but I showed up for Kevin and Bean the first day. I saw, you know, back in the mid-90s, I saw Bean's car parked out on the street, and Kevin's car was parked in the underground parking. And I just said to him, "Bean, what do you? It's you pull up here. It's dark. It's 4:45 in the morning, and you're like a celebrity. You're getting out of your car and just walking down this dark street. It's parked way down the street because there's a bunch of apartment buildings and stuff." And he said, "I don't want to pay the $30 a month."
Wow.
And I said, They don't give you a parking space underneath the building? You guys are the morning show. You're the jewel in the crown of the station, one of the biggest stations in America. You're the morning, just for security, just to pull in a secured parking lot and get in the elevator. It's like, nah, they charge.
Wow.
And I don't want to pay. And I thought, wow.
Yeah.
That's when I knew. And then Tower Air came along. But the peanut butter story with Jack Silver.
Oh, yeah. I got a random call from Jumpin' Jack, as we called him.
He called you.
What? Yeah, actually, yeah. He called me and said, hey, I'm not quite sure. You know, we're going to have to start charging Adam for the peanut butter. I said, what peanut butter? Like, I didn't even know what he was talking about. He's like, well, you know, he's charging the show for the peanut butter, and they go through a lot of peanut butter.
Go through a jar of Skippy every 16 days.
I'm like, am I being punked? Like, I didn't understand what he was talking. Like,
imagine in TV that happening.
I honestly.
Like someone from Comedy Central calling up and saying Jon Stewart's going through too much peanut butter.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't imagine. So I wound up saying, I'm like, Jack, I'll give you the goddamn $5 a month. Is that what it is? $5 a month for two jars of peanut butter? Like, you can take it out.
It could have been $6.25, to be fair to Jack.
It was welcome to radio.
Yes. Yes.
So what ended up happening?
I can't remember who.
He's allergic to peanuts.
Jack Mann came out on top.
That's right.
Once again.
Radio was sort of about sending a message, which was always, you're not that important. But the message I always got was, you're an asshole. Like, whenever someone tries to send me a message, I never get their message other than you're being a dick. Yeah. The message sending doesn't work. They do a lot of symbolic, like, here's the message we're sending. But the message I always get is, I don't ever want to fucking work with your ass again. That's the message I get from them. So for all those who are attempting to send a message, it's not all about the message. You got to check the antenna of the person you're sending it to and make sure they'll receive your message clearly. All right. Shall we do a little news?
Yes.
Oh, wait a minute, quickly. Just to make sure, Cousin Sal, the whole Christoph Waltz thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Is there any hyperbole or exaggeration when I say I wanted to bet some money on Christoph Waltz?
Have you spoken to Nick Santora about this? Because I do feel like he owes you something here. He's the one who stepped in between.
Yeah, I have. And he literally sat next to you. He was literally sitting next to you, drunk on Mangria.
Right, right.
And I said, $1,000 on Christoph Waltz. And he was like, don't do it.
Yeah.
And for those who don't know, Nick is one of the, you know, he's a guy on a real short list where if he told you not to do something, you'd go, this guy's a former attorney and, I don't know, prosecutor. And he's written 1,000 crime novels. Like, he must know something. Mm-hmm. And he does know almost everything.
Yeah.
So you listen to him. But God damn it. Christoph Waltz, who went from 20-1 to.
That was a great bet.
Number one. By the time the Academy Awards came around, he was number one.
You really stepped up. That was your crowning achievement. I mean, after being on the wrong side of the Patriots for the last decade.
Well, my new business is getting Patriots fans to pay me not to bet
smart.
On them.
That's smart. Yeah.
You know what I'm wondering? When people tell someone not to do something, does the person ever appreciate it? Like, do you ever hear a, thank you so much for warning me not to do that thing? When it comes down to, like, don't date that person, don't.
Not really.
No, I don't think I would have thanked him, but I did yell at him. But thank God he'd had some sort of bowel problem and was a complete and utter mess when I was talking to him.
He also has IBS.
He has something going. He said he's never stopped shitting, and he'd lost 30 pounds, and he was miserable, and he drank a can of Ensure, and he couldn't eat a piece of pizza. Right. And it was like, so he was equally as miserable when I spoke to him.
And that was Cousin Sal and James Baby Doll Dixon, Adam's agent, back in 2013.
Adam Carolla Show, 1037.
Yeah, Adam's still mad about that peanut butter thing.
It should be.
A couple days ago.
Nah, we can't afford to pay for peanut butter for our staff.
Before we get to this next one, though, I want to remind everybody, if you have a listener request, please email us, classics@adamcarolla.com. Tweet us at Giovanni Giorgio, at Chris Loxamana, Instagram, Facebook, whatever. Fax Gio. And let us know what you want to hear. This next clip is a listener request from Nicotime on Twitter.
Well, it's actually more common than that. Originally, Nicotime tweeted back in 2013, thanks for bringing back Terry the Pterodactyl. It's a favorite of mine. I requested at the Winnipeg live show. Get it on. And that's how I was able to find this clip. The request actually comes from Tim F. I need to hear Adam's Terry the Pterodactyl dropping into a volcano. He used the volcano emoji, which I appreciate. And this was done on the radio show a ton, and it never made its way really to the podcast. It barely ever gets brought up. And this is one of the rare moments it was actually brought up. And Adam talked about bringing the bit out of retirement. And thanks to Nick of Time, I was able to find it. Hope you enjoy it. Tim F., Adam Carolla Show 1028, Robert Davi, David Wilde, Allison Rose, and Brian Bishop. This is Before Robert, David Are There, Allison, Brian, and Adam for March of 2013.
Terry the Pterodactyl.
Stuff. The world is full of it. And one man can complain about it all. This is What Can't Adam Complain About?
All right, we'll toss it on. Oh, we're doing the video. That's right. All right, sorry, I had a busy day. The video, What Can't Adam Complain About? Who is this, by the way? Do we have these people's names anywhere?
Probably say the name, I imagine.
That's true. Go ahead and hit start.
Adam, this is Ross from California.
See?
You can't complain about tax rebates.
I could if I ever got a tax rebate.
You must have had a sweet spot in your life where you got a tax rebate or two.
No, but I had a very spotty relationship with the IRS. I had a lot of years where I didn't pay anything.
Like you have to file in order to get one?
You have to file in order to get one, and I didn't file, and then I ended up owing them $4,500, and then I worked out a payment program with them. And by the way, asking me how I, you know, can I complain about a tax rebate is like saying you can't complain about being blown by a unicorn, can you? Well, no, but it's just never happened and it's never going to happen. So what happened was is I owed him money, a bunch of money. Like I said, comically, Dr. Drew, who even though we've sort of arrived in the same place, started off on opposite ends of the pyramid, said to me when I was saying, look, I was 30. I owed the IRS like $4,400. And he just looked at me with a great white naivete and said the kind of thing you could only do if you went to Amherst, your mascot was Lord Jeff and your dad was a physician. He just looked at me and went, well, why didn't you pay it? He said, I didn't have $4,400 when I was 30 years of age. And he's like, but just pay it. I didn't have $400, not $4,400. And it was a great little moment where he could not perceive a man being 30. You know, he was a physician when he was 30.
So like just cash in some stocks.
Yeah. Let some of those muni bonds roll over.
End the CD like early that. If you have to.
Right. So I said, so that was funny, but I owed the IRS like $4,400. I did my payment program with them, which was like $29 a month for the rest of your life. Cause all you pay is tax and penalty. And, at some point I caught a break. A friend of mine was working for a show called Animaniacs for Warner Brothers. And he got me a job writing an episode of Animaniacs in like 1992. And it paid like $1,800, and I couldn't believe I was getting paid real money to write. And now I had I couldn't type or spell, so I'd have my friend Robbie do it all. And I said about 7,000 man hours into this, you know, 19-page script, but I still got paid to turn it. And when I, and this is a little lesson in life for everybody, when it came time to get my check, they said, ooh, IRS put a lien on it. And I said, IRS put a lien on it. Well, you owe the IRS money. I said, well, yeah, but I got a payment program worked out with them, and I've been doing it for like 2 years now. And they said, oh, all right, we'll call the IRS and talk to them, and then they'll talk to us, and then we'll release the check. And I said, okay. And I called the IRS, or I talked to somebody, and I said, hey, all right, we got a payment program worked out, so you shouldn't be putting a lien on this money. And they said, our bad. Yeah. And they said, we'll release it. And I said, okay, they shouldn't have done it. They said, we shouldn't have done it. And we made a mistake. And I said, okay, good. And so they made a mistake. And Warner Brothers released a check. And I got my $1,800. And then about 5 years later, I was buying my first house. And I was sitting in the bank. And the guy was typing up, doing the and he did the, ooh, what's this? You had a lien put on you from the IRS? And I was like, that's from $1,800, and that was a mistake. Lean on the IRS really does hurt the credit. And it's the moral of the story is this. No one ever goes back and fixes shit that they've already done because it doesn't mean shit to them because it's not their credit report that they give a fuck about. So they'll fuck up, then release the money, but they're not going to take the extra step to remove whatever.
To hit delete.
By the way, that doesn't go away by me telling friendly banker guy, oh, it was all just a big misunderstanding. And then he goes, well, let's just make that that little zit on your credit score disappear. No, it's there. It was I 3 years later, I was getting another loan. It's like, oh, boy, what do we got here? I'm like, really?
Is this still there?
I think after, I don't know, nine years or something like that, it'll roll off like a DUI or something like that. But 9 years of that shit. And every fucking time I went somewhere to buy something, I was like, because it just says IRS lien. Doesn't say for $1,800 and we released it because we made a goddamn mistake. Thank you. Here we go.
Hey, Adam. This is Curtis from Michigan, and I thought of something that you cannot complain about. You cannot complain about Pixar animated movies.
Oh.
You just can't do it, man.
Oh, yes, I can.
Hey, look, he has an Angria in the back.
He's holding up some Angria.
He just cheers you.
He's a hero. Yes, I've been to Pixar. I've been on a tour of Pixar. I went down to the writer's room of Pixar. I think some of the most creative story writing there is. And I say everyone who writes live action stuff should watch the Pixar stuff for the story and see how it all comes around and gets put back together at the end and everything else. I went down the writer's room and I said, boy, I am in love with your work. And I have done a lot. You know, somebody reminded me that they worked on, I was Buzz Lightyear's commander. I was Commander Nebula.
On the
syndicated show. I've now looking back on it between Crank Yankers and all, you know, being Spanky Ham and all that kind of stuff. And
Death,
by the way, which I'm doing on Thursday. I've done a lot of VO work, so it's not like, well, the guy doesn't do VO work. And then I went to the writers. Beautiful writers area over there at Pixar where they'll have their rooms all decorated with themes like speakeasies and jungle cruise bar lounges and tiki lounges
and
stuff
like that.
It's like
Madonna Inn.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, it's like Madonna Inn for smart people. And every single writer came out and went, hey, man, we're huge fans and we want you in car. Now, by the way, there's no bigger car maniac than me. Paul Newman starred in the first Cars. I own 5 of his fucking cars. Could you throw me a goddamn bone and give me a little VO work in one of these goddamn things? I couldn't play the part of a disgruntled El Camino or something, maybe even a minivan, something.
You played a taxi in Wizards of Waverly Place. You have experience as a car.
So I got my local Emmy. So I've done tons of VO work. I'm insane for cars. And everybody over at Pixar, at least on the writer's side, is a huge Adam Carolla fan. And there's 75 characters in these things. Not so much as a goddamn syllable tossed toward the Ace Man. All right, last one. Here we go.
I don't think Adam can complain about the guys that clean up the graffiti along the freeway. That's what I do.
I'm surprised we didn't see a chick just dive onto his cock with her open mouth before he finished that.
We cut that
out.
We cut that out.
Or she could have been below the frame.
Because normally when you just say out loud, I'm the guy who cleans up graffiti on the side of the freeway, it's like chicks, they hear it like those old dog food commercial, and they just come running.
Like a shark with a drop of
blood. Drop of blood. They smell it from 6 miles
out.
I'm
having trouble sitting in this chair right now. I wanted to just... Yeah. Slide towards the screen.
Slide off.
Yes, I can complain that.
Just got that. Towel, please.
I pay this guy, and I don't know what this. I don't know what the debt is, but these guys work for the city. They work for city maintenance, Caltrans, whatever the hell, whatever group they're in. Anytime you put on an orange vest, you're getting paid at least $28 an hour. Then you're in a nice big fat union and you got lots of dentists. You got your hospital and your dentistry and all that stuff taken care of. I mean, you got a good pension plan and everything. It's a pretty good gig working for the city. Think about the number of people. Like, you look at it this way. How many people do we have working for the city? We're like, okay, we have firemen working for the city, and that's good because sometimes fires break out or people have heart attacks, and guys that are EMTs and all that, that's good working for the city. And the guys that fix the roads, that's good working for the city. And the school teachers, but good working for the city. But then we have to employ an army of cops and guys who remove graffiti and probation officers and folks who work in prisons. I mean, I'll bet you the army, we have a small battalion of people that we employ to do good, and then we have an army of people we employ because we have assholes.
To clean up after the assholes.
They have to clean up after them. They have to incarcerate them. They have to tell them it's your 50 UI. Now you have to put this ankle bracelet on. I'm your public defender. I was assigned to you, paid for by Adam Carolla. My
whole
thing
say
is,
who personally paid
well,
for that.
My thing is, instead of me parceling my tax dollars out to everything, I just want one Predator drone with my fucking name on it. It would be much nicer for me to go, all right,
yeah,
it's all my money's going into one place. But the point is we have a city now that has a handful of people that are doing good for the city. They're answering 911 telephones, and they're helping your kid with a learning disability, and then an ever-growing army of people to deal with assholes who get paid just as much and oftentimes more than the other people. Now, we could enlarge that army, or we could start trying to do away with the assholes that are destroying our society.
How would we do away with them?
First thing we would do is judge. For instance, if you see somebody tagging something, do not approach them. That's what they tell you to do with that. But there's signs all over the freeway that says report drunk driving, buzz driving is drunk driving, drive hammered, get nailed, right? I mean, it's all just report this, do this, do that, do this. 55 saves mm-hmm. lives, click it or ticket. It's a 55 zone. We're in a slow zone. We're in a cone zone. Is there anything that says anything about graffiti? Is there ever a graffiti hotline? Is there ever, you're driving along the freeway. The Southern California freeways are covered with barbed wire because of graffiti. They're also covered with graffiti. So we got the barbed wire and we have the fucking graffiti. It's really insane. It's like saying, we got a snake problem in the house. So we're going to get a mongoose in here to get rid of the snakes. And now we have more snakes and more mongooses or mongeeses.
All of them.
All of them in one house. At least get rid of the fucking snakes. So yeah. We got the barbed wire, and we have the graffiti, and there it is, and there it remains, and there it shall be. Now, is there any awareness program? Is there any? Why aren't, since the lion's share of it is taking place on the freeways, where we are, in our cars, with our cell phones and our eyeballs, why don't those freeway signs say, report graffiti?
Yeah, like on cars, you see bumper stickers that say, how's my driving?
Right.
Sometimes they say 1-800-EAT-SHIT, but sometimes right. There's a real number. And it could right. Say, how's my graffiti?
Right. So ours say 55 saves lives or click it or ticket. Totally moot. We have a graffiti problem. Says nothing about graffiti. And we can look forward to a nice more 4 years of this. Also, the reality is it becomes some sort of cultural thing, and then it becomes an ethnic thing, and no one's going to touch that thing, because if a certain group does it more than another group, then you can't come down on that group. And I want to come down on the group that does graffiti. I don't give a fuck.
Oh, the artists?
If they all look like Conan O'Brien. There was a commercial that basically, there was this great commercial, we can't find it, but it showed people doing graffiti and then like showed that. The nobility of it somehow, but or that you could get an, you know, you could, if you could do this, you can get a high school diploma or whatever it is. But I'm curious. I swear to God, we spend more money on the people that are either trying to protect us from assholes or undo the work of assholes than we do for the people that are teaching our kids, protecting us from fire and filling the potholes. And imagine how many fucking schools we could build if we just took this massive group of assholes and somehow got rid of them. And here's how you somehow can get rid of them. I'd like to throw them in a fucking volcano. Personally, I would like to get my pterodactyl, Terry. It's been a while. And pick them up and drop them into a fucking fiery volcano. But that we cannot do that. But I'll tell you what we can do. We can stop the next generation of assholes. But that's going to take a dialogue, and that's going to take a little bit of finger pointing with a sprinkling of judging. And I don't think you're going to find that here.
Sounds I prefer like, the pterodactyl plan.
Yeah. Me too.
Sounds like a campaign slogan to me. Stop the next generation of assholes.
Oh, could easily be done.
You know, Gavin Newsom suggested it, and we should, Mike August, if you're listening, which I know you're not, we should have a runoff debate here. That would be a landmark moment for podcasts. That'd be awesome, because there's runoff candidates now.
Yeah, but no one's coming here.
That'd be awesome.
Not after Gavin awesome. Newsom got drowned out in the deep water.
And that's Terry the Pterodactyl on the Adam Carolla Show back in 2013. Thank you again, Tim and Nicotime, for reminding us about that clip.
I tried to be silly and tweet at Clark Gregg, a previous recent guest on the show. He posted that some giant bird took a crap on his car, and it was like a pterodactyl must have done it. And I saw a tweet, and I was like, Adam Carolla has a pterodactyl. He also has a pegasus, but he uses his pegasus for flying fecal-based revenge schemes, not his pterodactyl.
Yeah.
So I tweeted at Clark Gregg and Adam. I go, this is a Jennifer thing.
Yeah, I think Adam's hands are clean.
Of course, because he employs his pegasus to go poop on other people's cars.
That's right. All right. Gee, you ready to get motivated? Because this next clip features one of the most motivational guys in the biz.
Dave Damashek.
Dave, it does. You are just right. You are on it, man. No, this is Jocko.
From Adam Carolla Show 2085, featuring Jocko Willink, David Damashek, Gina Grad, and Brian Bishop. This is from June 2017, and happens to be Jocko's ACS debut.
Jocko Willink here. Way of the Warrior Kid, from Wimpy to Warrior. The Navy SEAL way. Who would know better than Jocko? Black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Commander of SEAL Team 3. U.S. Navy SEAL. First deployed in Baghdad in 2003 and retired in 2010. Good to see you again, Jocko.
What's happening?
You know, I thought of you this morning. I took my freezing cold shower, as I always do, first thing in the morning, just to punish myself a little bit. I am not jumping in the pool anymore because it's too warm. Mm. Ambient temperature is a little warm. And I thought, you can get so much out of punishing yourself just a little bit. Jocko probably takes it to extremes. I do it just a little bit. But I don't know when we started to run from that. It's not serving us well. And I'm glad you're here to talk about it.
Self-punishment can go a long way sometimes.
I've found that folks need to push themselves.
This music that you just put on is punishing, actually. I didn't know what that was.
The more you know.
Let's talk about the book. I'm glad you gave a couple to my kids, because boy, do they need this book.
Sure, it'll be read right away.
That's always my time.
The first thing I'm amazed about is watching my soon-to-turn 11-year-old son and his 11-year-old buddies all hanging around and playing nice all day long. And I'm like, why have you not wrestled those kids to the ground? That's all we did, is get people in headlocks. All we did was one big headlock. If you were standing there and not paying attention, someone came up behind you, got in a headlock, and then tried to throw you on the ground. Absolutely. They don't touch each other.
That's very strange. They should be attacking each other pretty much throughout the day at random times.
I agree. Like the Pink Panther. I agree. I mean, didn't you spend your formative years just wrestling with your buddies?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's how you establish the pecking order, right?
Who do you know who the alpha male is? Yeah. It's the alpha silverback.
Exactly.
I never even thought of this, but then we'll get into the book. My number one pastime in high school is I had a friend named Tom.
Okay.
This guy was built like a brick house, and he got like best physique back when they would give out best physique. It was funny. He was black, and he was our only rich friend. His dad was a hand surgeon.
Defying all stereotypes.
Yes. And he thus had a swimming pool. None of us had a swimming pool. He also had a diving board in his big swimming pool that just extended into the over the pool like 6-7 feet.
And he swam in the pool?
Brian.
How dare you?
I'm just asking for the listeners.
We would spend every summer night, you would stand at the end of the diving board and you'd get in your position. And then him or Ray or my buddy Chris, the other strong guys, would try to throw you off the diving board, and whoever got thrown off got to be in the catbird seat for the next fight.
For the King of the Hill kind
of thing. We did was fight on this diving board. That's all we did. There was nothing else to do, and it was wildly gratifying, and everyone enjoyed it, and everyone was sort of equal in mm-hmm. their own way and had their own strengths and weaknesses, mm-hmm. and we just go at it, and if anyone won three in a row, it was a huge, huge deal, but those days are gone, right, Jacko?
They certainly seem to be disappearing a little bit, although the other day I walked down to the beach where my son was down there. My son's 14. When I walked down there, he was in a full-on brawl with some other kid, friend of his. They're, you know, a friendly fight, but they were smearing sand into each other's ears and pretty much beating the crap out of each other, so I was impressed.
I'm trying to think of, yes, Brian.
The harbinger of your story, just back to that on the diving board and all that stuff, diving boards can't build them anymore,
nope.
At least here in California.
Yeah.
That's an indicator.
That's so insane that there's no diving board.
Also, not to take a turn for the gay, but I think we were naked, but it couldn't get any straighter than what we were doing. Being naked made it straighter, like sort of Roman days.
Yeah, like sometimes it gets
now,
so
me having
gay,
a boner obviously crossed into a different territory.
Well, that's your affair.
That's a mitigating
that's me,
factor.
But the rest of the guys... It was Colosseum battling. Yeah, so...
Sometimes it's so gay, it comes around to heterosexuality.
Very true. Yeah. Like chaps. Mm-hmm. All right, so the book. Let's talk about the book, and thank you for signing it to my son. I appreciate it. Let's talk about what's in the book and why my son needs to read this book.
So, a book is about a kid. He's in fifth grade, and he's got some issues going on. He can't do any pull-ups, so he's getting called out for not being able to do any pull-ups. He doesn't know his times tables, which sucks when you're in fifth grade because you're supposed to know your times tables. He doesn't know how to swim, and he's getting picked on by Kenny Williamson, the school bully.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the book starts out last day of school, and all those things kind of collapse down on him at the same time. And he's really bummed out, goes behind the library, he's crying, he goes home. And when he gets home, he remembers, his mom reminds him, that his uncle is coming to stay with him for the summer. His uncle was in the SEAL teams and is now getting out of the SEAL teams and he's going to go to college. But for the summer, he's going to stay with his sister and with his nephew. So that's Uncle Jake. And so they start talking and hanging out. And Uncle Jake says, you know, what are you going to do tomorrow? You're going to go for a swim? You want to go play some basketball? What do you want to do? And the kid, whose name is Mark, you know, says, well, actually, I can't swim and I can't play sports and I'm not good at anything. I can't do any pull-ups. So he breaks down, starts crying. And his Uncle Jake says, wait a second. So you don't know your times tables. You don't know how to swim. You can't do any pull-ups and you're getting picked on. Those are your issues. And he says, yeah, you know, it's horrible. And he says, it's not horrible. We can fix all those things. And so they spend the summer training, working out, learning how to fight, learning how to study, studying the times tables and learning how to swim. And that's what the story is about.
Awesome.
Was the book your idea?
The book was my idea, yes.
And I'm guessing not to just make a couple of bucks or sell a few units, but to fill some sort of void that we're heading toward as a society, which I've been complaining about for a long time now.
Well, absolutely. You know, with my first book that came out was called Extreme Ownership. It was a book about leadership. And that book was focused, obviously, for adults. And a lot of people along the way were saying, it'd be really good if we had these kind of lessons for kids. And that what kind of got me started on it. Another thing that got me started on was that I had four kids of my own. I have three girls and one boy. And I was out trying to get a book for my son. And this was years ago. Just trying to get a good book for my son. For him to read.
Mm-hmm.
About, you know, boy things. And so I got him this pirate book. Right?
Right.
Pick pirates on the cover. And I'm thinking, cool. You know, pirates are going to go out, break things, destroy ships, take over countries, whatever. Just get after it. And of course, I open the book and I start reading it to him. And these are the most pathetic, embarrassing pirates you've ever seen that are talking about sharing and how we want to be equal. And I just shut the book. I burned
aboard
it.
Aboard! Everyone, get on the Rainbow Warrior! Now! There's a Japanese whaler! Let's head it off!
Exactly.
Socialist pirates?
All these books that are telling kids, you know, that, well, you don't want to be strong and you don't want to work hard and you don't want to push your personal ability any further. You just want to sit back and allow, you know, the collective to take care of you. And so that was another thing that made me write the book.
Well, I have this notion now, and I'll apply it to males, which is, so we have this thing that we always talk about, this like shrinking middle class. You know, we have the very poor people, and then we have the very rich people, and this chasm seems to be growing larger. I don't know if it's a talking point, if it's actually happening, but I'm just assuming it does feel like we're creating like two separate Americas, rich America and poor America. And I'm now thinking about this in terms of dudes. I think we're going to have super studs that never stop training in the octagon, and then super pussy man purse. You've invaded my personal space. I felt, you know, I got my coexist bumper sticker on my Prius. We're just going to have a class of super puss and super dude.
What are you talking about?
Yes, sorry, Sonny. Get in the Prius, put the sticker on the bumper, and make your way to your Primal Scream Therapy encounter group. I think the powers that be are going to create more. This is my thought about why MMA is the fastest growing sport, because we need this outlet, because we're sitting in air conditioning on our ergonomically sculpted chairs. I think there's going to be a group of extreme dudes that are out just doing all those tough mutter things and all the octagon and MMA stuff and training super ultra hard and, you know, jumping off an iceberg into freezing water, and then just the super panic pussy dudes. Mm-hmm. And I think the middle class, which was like, hey, dude could pull the spark plugs out of his Chevy and put some new plugs in. He wasn't going to rebuild the transmission, but if it broke down, he could pull off the side of the road and check a few things. He wasn't a prize fighter, but he could handle himself if somebody was hitting on his old lady or whatever it was. Like, there was a sort of, he could change a spare on his car. He could drive a stick, you know. He wasn't a master mechanic or a journeyman carpenter, but he knew how to get the sticky window unstuck in the house. Like, there was a sort of mid-ground.
There was a minimum standard for being a man.
Those are out the window now, and I feel like all we're going to have is super puss and extreme dude.
You know, though, I think that the extreme group is going to grow, because I think it's very instinctual for boys to be drawn towards this, and I think you actually have to work to pull them away from fighting, right? Like you said, when we were kids, you just scrapped. That was just the way it was. Yeah. Oh, you want a piece of my candy? You can't have it. Okay, we're going to fight. You know, that's it. Oh, you want to borrow my pen? You can't have it. Now we're going to fight. That's very instinctual for boys, and I think we've been trying to pull them away from it, and I think if we open up that door a little bit, boys will be boys.
Well, we decided, and I've talked to Dr. Drew about this for a million years, we decided that basically there was the sort of feminine route and there was the masculine route, and that the feminine route was the route to progress. So masculine was
more evolved.
Yeah, caveman, hair pulling, fighting, you know, settling stuff with our fists. That was us. That was, you know, 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And now the evolved move is this way.
You can talk about your problems as opposed to fighting about it.
Yeah, or anything. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of feminine route and a masculine route, and we were going to do the Massengale route versus the brute route. Ooh, I like that. Yeah. Write that down by Fabergé. So we decided, oh, it's more evolved. This is more evolved. And yeah, at a certain point, it was like, hey, guys shouldn't be having fist fights on the property at the open house at the school because the one dad's giving the other dad the stink eye. Like, I get it. And if you want to have sex with a woman, you're not allowed to get her in a headlock and drag her into a cave. You have to give her roofies like Bill Cosby.
Yeah. There's a process.
Isn't it? We're evolving is what I'm saying. No, they were right to a point. But then they started crossing over, and it's sort of like PETA. PETA's like, you know, 25 years ago, hey, those chickens should be kept in a humane condition. They're living off their own fecal matter and scratching each other to death. And you go, all right, I don't like that. They should be free range or something. And someone would go, well, what do you think? Oh, I'll pay an extra buck for a chicken if it's not being tortured. Why not? I'm an atheist, but who cares? Now you're wearing faux suede and they're throwing paint on you at the movie premiere, and they've crossed into a weird area that doesn't make sense to us anymore. I think we can all agree with animals not being tortured, but they start crossing over into some area that doesn't make sense. And I feel like we're doing that with this whole feminine masculine thing. We can't even do he and she anymore. We don't have separate bathrooms. It's just this whole thing, and it's all going if it toggled between the masculine and the feminine, I'd be fine. Be like, all right, we'll give you, all right, so we'll have one bathroom that everyone will use. All right, that's done. Yours. And I'd like to take a leak on my front lawn, speaking of bathroom, without any prying eyes or repercussions.
And how?
Okay, that's ours. Okay, but it didn't. It just went all feminine all the way, all the time, and it's not helping us.
Now, I have a notion slash question, and maybe it's unanswerable, but Jocko, I'm interested in your take on this, because what you guys are talking about all applies to boys for the most part. I have an 8-month-old daughter, and I can't speak to, you know, books that are for boys, pirates and things like that, or whatever books are aimed for boys, but I do know that when we had, you know, Christy had her showers, people would get us gifts, we had a lot of books for girls, and a lot of those books, the vast majority, if not all of them, were very much empowering. You know, like you can do anything. You can do anything. You know, almost masculinizing the girl part. So it was almost like, do you think as the male gets a little more feminine, the feminine's getting a little more male? Does that make sense? Because I'm kind of dealing with a thought that I'm having here for the first time.
Can I just say that off the top of my head, it sounds like as the masculine gets more feminine, the feminine gets more condescending? I can't do anything? Yeah. Oh, okay. I didn't realize there was an option. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I actually have, like I said, three girls and one boy. And the first kid that read the book was my 7-year-old daughter when she was 6 years old. And the thing is, the problems that are addressed in the book, they're not just boy problems. They're problems for everyone. And if you think girls don't get picked on and girls don't bully each other, they're savage, straight up, even worse than boys in some cases, because they don't just do the physical. You know, if you and me throw down over a piece of candy, that's cool. We're done in 15 seconds. We split the candy and it's all good. Girls, you know, they can hold a grudge and they'll do the psychological warfare on each other. It gets really crazy. But the book, the book isn't really necessarily written just for boys. Mm-hmm. It's written for kids, because kids have issues. And what the book is about, you know, it's not necessarily about a kid that can't do pull-ups. It's about a kid that can't do something. Mm-hmm. You pick that thing. How do you get better at that thing? Well, the way you get better at it is you have to work at it. And every example in that book comes from raising my own kids. For instance, my oldest daughter, she didn't know her times tables when she was in, you know, third grade or whatever it was. And she actually thought she was stupid. You know, she came home, she was sad. You know, I'm dumb. I'm not as smart as the other kids. And I said, well, why do you think that? She said, well, I don't know my times tables. And I said, well, you know, how much have you studied them? And she says, what do you mean? And she didn't even know. It didn't occur to her that you had to study. She just sat there in class when they went over them and thought she was supposed to know them. And I said, no, actually, you need to make flashcards. Here's how you do that. And now you need to study them. And in an hour, she knew her times tables. So boom, problem solved. And that's one of the things that goes on in the book. But kids these days, they just think they should know everything, or they no one teaches them how to learn, or no one teaches them, hey, if you want to be able to do pull-ups, guess what? You got to do some kind of working out over the summer. You just don't get naturally gifted to be able to do pull-ups. That's the way it works.
The thing that always bothers me now about this new world order is we have this new thing where we just explain to all girls they're beautiful. So whatever your shape, whatever your size, whatever you are, you're beautiful.
We should be saving it for the Gina Grads of the world.
Absolutely. You got to go D cup plus, man. I don't care what grade you're in. Instead of deciding everyone is beautiful, which is insane because everyone knows who's beautiful and who's not beautiful, we'll decide. We'll figure it out. You can't foist that upon guys. There is this bizarre misunderstanding that comes from women and the far left, which is we can make you feel a certain way about things if we hit you hard enough with shame. No, you cannot. You cannot explain to us what's beautiful. Our cock and balls will decide what's beautiful, and it'll never change. It'll never change, and you can't get us to change.
But can I just ask, what about like different decades? If you know, they do sketches of like the most beautiful figure of the, you know, 1820s and the most beautiful figure of the 1920s.
My dick and balls are here now.
The body types are very different.
I wouldn't say
one's zoftig, one's boyish.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, the Sophia Loren will never go out of style. Just ever, whatever category you're in. And yeah, there's trends, and I put on a couple of pounds. But I will tell you, no guy I know ever signed off on the waif model.
On Twiggy,
we did not.
Kate Moss,
we did not. That was something that gay fashion designers were trying to foist on us. We didn't sign off on that. We wanted some bosom and some hips. So this thing where it's like, well, you used to like bosom and hip and now you don't. No, yes, we do. We don't want the 13-year-old boy with the B cup or the A cup. We never said, I never signed off on that. I never knew any dude who signed off on it. That was you trying to graft your shit on us. It never takes. It never works. You should spend time in more fruitful ways. So this notion that we're going to come around or be evolved or understand, No. We'll do stuff like gay marriage and pot, where we just go, all right, look, I'm tired of arguing about it. You want to smoke pot, smoke pot. You want to marry dude, I'll be over here. And we'll pretend to care, but that's about as far as we go with stuff. But your version of what we're attracted to, never.
Doesn't change.
Never going to work. So I would suggest that we stop calling everyone beautiful and get off the subject of beautiful. Why does everyone need to be beautiful? It's a weird thing because you're kind of punching a hole in your own ship when you say no, she's not beautiful. Everybody is beautiful. Stop mm-hmm. using the word beautiful. Let's focus on the mind. Yeah. Let's focus on ability. Yeah, the sort of things like everyone can do everything they want to do, and we're all beautiful. Like, stop focusing on the aesthetic. You're coming back to this aesthetic all the time. If you really want to be true to it, drop the aesthetic and just go, look, my idea of beauty is you going out and starting a company or running something or doing whatever you want to do in life. We don't have to keep circling back to the aesthetic.
Brian, Tessa's fine.
Thank you.
That's right.
She's good
that.
Enough.
I'll tell her that in 10 years.
Yeah, she's a five.
Then we can all agree.
Babies go.
We can all agree.
All right, yes.
Question, you talk about, you know, you have four kids and three girls, and it sounds like you parent them fairly similarly. You don't say, you know, one way for the boy and one way for the girls. Do you have a rule that they have to be participating in things? Does that only go for the boy? How important is it that they don't kind of make their own schedule, sit around if they want, that kind of thing?
Well, there's a definite balance you have to take there, because anytime you try and force people to do anything, they're going to resent it and they're going to rebel against it. So you can't just impose things on people. And it goes with, from a leadership perspective, if I've got people that work for me and all I do is impose on them how they're going to do everything, sure, they'll do it for the paycheck, but they're out looking for another job. And it's the same thing.
Hi, Gary.
It's the same thing with your kids. If you're imposing what you want your kids to do, then eventually they go, you know, I don't like doing this. But if you say, hey, look, this is why you're doing it. This is why I want you to do this, because it's going to make you physically fit, because it's going to make you able to defend yourself, because it's going to make your mind work better, because it's going to make you do better in school, and that's going to give you more options in life, and that's why I want you to do this. And you explain to people why they're doing it and explain to your kids why you want them to do it, then they will be more apt to actually follow through with what it is you want them to do. I mean, think about it. All kids, you order them to do something, and they don't like it. And it's not just kids. It's anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not because I said so. You actually give them a reason.
You have to give them a reason why. It's just like being a leadership, just like being a leader in the SEAL teams. You can't just order, you go charge that machine gun nest and everyone's just going to do it. No, actually, they won't do it. You have people that say, hey, boss, that's not happening. We're not going to go die running this machine gun nest. We want to figure out a different plan. And if your attitude is, no, I told you to do it. Well, this is why in Vietnam, officers got fragged and killed by their men. Because they said, no, we're not doing that. Whereas if you say, okay, well, what's your plan? How this is our objective. Why don't you come up with a good solution on how we can overcome that? And then the team says, okay, we can do that. And then they come up with their own plan. And now when they execute the plan, it's their plan, not your plan.
They're more invested in it.
And they're more invested in it. They own the plan themselves. People ask me all the time, how do you get people to take ownership of a plan? You let them come up with a plan. Then they get ownership of it, and then they execute it. Same thing with your kids.
Wow. The great Jimmy Kimmel once told me that. 20, coming on 25 years ago. It's like, if you want to do something around here at K-Rock, you got to make Kevin Weatherly, the program director, think it was his idea.
Absolutely.
And if he thinks it's his idea, you can get it done. If you come in and go, this is my idea and we need to do it, it's probably not going to get done. But if you say, I love that idea,
hey, Kevin,
we were talking
about.
Kevin,
I was thinking about a thing you mentioned the other day.
Which one refreshed me?
Blow Adam for VW Beetle competition we're talking about with Kevin and me?
Fine, I'll do it.
Right. I thought about it. And right. I really...
Initially, I was hesitant.
Now I'm on board. And as you know, no one receives oral like me. I don't claim to give it. But no one receives better than me. And
that's
a lot. Brian, you've been around long enough to know. There's been a lot of guys who've challenged that. But I say, bring it.
They've thrown their hat in the ring. Throw the Jimmy hat in the ring.
I say, bring it.
Yep.
Now, not performing.
Taking on all comers.
Not performing oral.
That's right.
Receiving.
Yeah. It's an important distinction.
We do have a live show coming up.
Nobody. Well, okay. You want to test? Dennis Prager's going to be out there? All right. We got to test it. We'll test it. I'm saying nobody receives bread. I'm not bragging about my ability.
Feels like you're bragging.
Only to receive.
Feels like you're bragging. Mm. Without bragging, if you can back it up.
That's right. All right. Get ready with the news, shall you, Gina Grad?
And that was Jocko Willink back in 2017 making his Corolla Show debut. Now, before we get to our last clip, Gio, I want to remind everybody that if you haven't rated the show on Apple Podcasts, please do so. It helps out the show. So just leave us a rating. Let everybody know what you think of the show. And tell a friend. Tell a friend about this show and share the wealth and the goodness that is Corolla Classics. All right. This last clip features documentarian / legend Ken Burns sitting with Adam one-on-one.
All the way back in 2010, Adam Carolla Show 375 from September 2010. Ken Burns and Adam one-on-one talking docs.
Dearest Martha, my soul is weary from the toil and hardship of battle. The only thing that heartens me in these troubled times are thoughts of your lovely visage, and this exchange by a historian and a witty man by the name of Corolla, an Italian, I believe, but he might be a Hebrew. Mr. Corolla's jibes and witticisms make my heart soar. I suggest you listen forthwith. Colonel Michael E. Dawson, Glendale Regiment.
Well, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get it on. Mandate, get it on. I feel weird saying that in front of Ken Burns, documentarian and all-around good guy. Ken has a new documentary coming out September 28th and 29th. That is coming up this September 28th and 29th on PBS. It's called Baseball, and it's the 10th inning. We've already done it's 94-2. Yesterday?
92 to yesterday.
Oh, 92 to yesterday.
Yeah, we came out in 94 with our 9-episode, 9-inning, 18-and-a-half-hour, which you think would be enough, to which we've added 2 2-hours, so we have 4 more hours.
What's your longest documentary to date?
Baseball, and now Baseball plus the 10th inning.
I saw The War, which is just unbelievable.
Thank you.
I'm trying to think. Is it how much of what you do is just dogged determination and patience? Meaning, you know, if you're Bruckheimer, it's a different part of your brain, I guess, you're,
yes,
you're using.
I think
if
so.
You're making a film and you're making one that's just involved in, like, you know, what if somebody says, we need a documentary on the Civil War and you have 7 weeks to do it? It's impossible.
We say
right?
no to. Yeah, no, we want to. You know, most documentaries are, or at least in the past, documentaries have been homework. You know, they're castor oil, something you know is good for you. It's somebody telling you what you should know. And we avoid that. We'd like to tell you something we've discovered. So our whole process gets attenuated because we don't have a research period followed by a scripting period and then follow the template that script represents through shooting and editing. Mm-hmm. We never stop researching. We never stop writing. We're the last day of editing. We're rewriting something in the stuff. So it takes a really long time, but allows you to add layers of nuance and to get stuff that you didn't get, to have, you know, very complex parallel constructions in the structure of the film. And it's the only way I know how to do it. I've been doing that for 35 years, and that's it.
Is castor oil the same as cod liver oil?
Yes,
and then
it is.
Which one tastes worse? They're both bad?
They're both very, very bad to taste. And they're really, really good for you.
Really?
You literally have to hold your nose and you go like this and you think that people had to take it every single day. And they did. Like my dad took it every single day, and that's why it explains a lot.
Have you ever? That's why he was so angry and
yes,
holding his nose
exactly.
all the time.
Exactly.
And have you ever had brewer's yeast, by the way?
Yes, I have.
That's another thing that's supposed to be good for you that tastes horrible.
It's
why would
not
God
so bad.
Do this? Do a documentary on
why
God would punish us.
The punishment of all the good stuff is like...
Yeah, why are ho-hos delicious but are going to kill you, but cod liver oil
and tofu,
brewer's yeast
and
tofu. Do a doc on that.
I had a patch where I would sometimes sprinkle brewer's yeast on grapefruit, and it was actually all right. And it was like a granola-y thing.
But it's almost like when martial artists punch a piece of birch. Yes, you know what I mean? Right. Like that's just you trying to toughen up your palate,
okay,
right?
No, well, you know, life...
You're taking the two worst-tasting things on the planet and combining them.
See, I think it all went wrong when Thomas Jefferson said... He could have followed John Locke and said, life, liberty, and property. We understand that. Get the hell off my gland, or I'm going to shoot you. But he said, pursuit of happiness. And we didn't know what that meant. And was the pursuit of the happiness after things in a marketplace, or was it a lifelong learning of the mind and the heart, which is what I think it was.
Right.
But I think a lot of it has been, we think that we are deserving of happiness and that anything that's friction, difficult, oppositional, like
castor oil,
brewer's yeast, and tofu, it's not for us.
Well,
so we're fat. We're dying of heart disease. We have diabetes.
Right.
And
well, we think we're happy, but we're not.
And we think we're happy, but we're not.
Well, you know, I've always said this. The best way to... I always talk about this when I talk about comedy, which is it needs a little pathos mixed in there to make the comedy pay off.
Mark Twain said, the source of laughter is not joy, but sorrow. There is no laughter in heaven.
Hold on. Google... Matt Twain?
Mark Twain.
Mark Twain.
He's a famous American.
A lot of our listeners don't know.
Famous American writer, yeah.
Yeah, all right. We're going to check that
He wrote, yeah, he's a pretty funny dude.
You know Twain's. Yeah,
Twain's.
There's a restaurant.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Check that out.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's true. I always say...
he also said, by the way, that it's not that the world is filled with fools. It's just that lightning isn't distributed right. Which will be funny in 1,000 years when no other humorist from the 19th century has any... I mean, when they fired in the back of Lincoln's brain in Our American Cousin, which was a comedy, the line that got the laugh that gave Booth the sort of the cover to shoot was, you sock-dologizing old man trap.
Really?
It's really not funny now,
right,
considering what happened.
But that's what created the laughter in the theater.
Yeah, you sock-dologizing old man trap. Ah, ha, 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 poof, like that. But Twain...
Right.
The things he said, like lightning being distributed right, is going to be around. And if we haven't gotten rid of our species in 1,000 years, that will still be funny.
Well, it's funny because there's a Nick Cage movie. You know, every Nick Cage movie either involves some historical event, like Lincoln being shot, or the extinction of our species.
Exactly.
So
right.
He's doing double duty.
He's heading backwards or forwards.
Well, speaking of... I was thinking about this before you started talking about Matt Twain and what his legacy was and is. I was thinking for you and the work that you do, this stuff it's forever, and it's the first time that it was... I mean, these things have been documented in various ways, shapes, and forms. There's been a lot of, you know, World at War kind of stuff, World War II, and there's been plenty of documentaries made on baseball, but not a definitive... sort of we took everything and put it under one roof kind of collection. And so 100 years from now or 2,000 years from now, when somebody wants to know about the World War II or when they want to know about baseball, they'll go to your work, theoretically.
That
and that's
nice.
Got to be a pretty nice
Well, you know,
feeling.
A lot of it is exciting. And it's nice to see that they are evergreen. And you hope that the emotional archaeology that we are partaking in will last and be durable, that it isn't just going to be about the buckle collectors or the guys who are interested in the caliber of the guns or the movement of regiments, but a human story that we try to tell. The Civil War was bottom-up as well as top-down. The World War II, of which it's the only film that I've ever done in which the territory was filled with other projects, hundreds, thousands of documentaries, but no one had decided to try to tell the two theaters, the European and the Pacific Theater, simultaneously as they happened. World of War didn't do it. Nobody did A Victory at Sea. And nobody tried to then also fold in the home front as well as a bottom-up thing. So we took four geographically distributed American towns, Waterbury, Connecticut, Mobile, Alabama, Sacramento, California, and tiny, tiny Laverne, Minnesota, and said, let's see the war through their eyes,
right,
how they went off to the war. It didn't mean that it was any limited in that way. The scope could be global, but you could find the universe in a grain of sand.
What are some of the documentaries that you've liked over the years, other than all of yours, which Ken normally says, he rattles off his 15, and then he gets to everyone else's. But what is your, what are some that have moved you, or maybe ones that you saw when you were younger that made you want to get into this?
Yeah, I know. I actually, my mom died when I was 11, and my dad had a really strict curfew. But if there was a movie on TV that lasts till 1 a.m. on a school night, he'd let me stay up and watch it, like an old movie. Or he'd take me to the Cinema Guild and or to the Revival House, where I'd see European stuff as well. And I watched my dad cry for the first time, and I realized, like 12 or 13 years old, this is what I want to do. Because I understood why he hadn't been able to deal with the stuff going on in our family, but he could deal with it through a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized the power of the medium. So I wanted to be Howard Hawks or John Ford or some such other director of the time. And then I went to Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts in 71. And everybody was a social documentary still photographer. They were interested in the truth of what is and what was. And all of a sudden, I had my molecules rearranged, and I'm now interested in doing documentaries. And that combined with a completely untrained interest in history to start doing this sort of stuff. And that's where it came from.
My stepdad took me to see Smoking the Bandit once when I was 13, and that was my experience with the cinema.
You know what's
kind of nice is, you know, if you want to make movies, you're going to take your lumps. I mean, if you want to get into this business, I don't care how much money you've made. I mean, you know, Robert De Niro has 5 stinkers, you know. Marlon Brando has a few stinkers in there. Everybody has a couple of stinkers, even the great directors and the writers and blah, blah, blah. The thing that's got to be nice about making documentaries is... I'm sure some are received better than others, but you never get any 1.5 stars on any of these babies, do you?
No. I mean, every once in a while you get a critic who's decided that they're going to take you down for the pretentiousness with which you've decided to approach baseball or some other such thing. Or maybe you find a jazz or Roddy guy who thinks that, you know, because you left out the second sideman in Count Basie's band between 47 and 48, you've failed miserably, that you weren't the telephone book.
So you do have some credits.
And so it's a really nice sort of thing. And it's kind of cool to be able to respond to them. Because you always go and you say, okay, so who of today's, or criticism that you didn't do modern jazz guys, I would say, who are of today's jazz guys are as important as Louis Armstrong or Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis, John Coltrane? And they'll go, well, we won't know for 25 years. I go, yeah, and that's called history, you know.
And there's your answer.
And there's your answer.
So now, baseball, and are these doc, as far as picking a documentary, and do you get pissed off when people call the doc, like I get pissed off when people call Curb Your Enthusiasm Curb?
I hate it only when they call me K. But doc's okay. I don't ever use it when people say, yeah, I like docs, meaning they don't like docs.
And that was Ken Burns hanging out with Adam back in 2010. Oh, we had a good weekend, Gio.
We did. And Podcast One Premium, if you want to hear any of these full episodes we played today, all the clips we played are full episodes you can find there. If you have anything you want us to play, recommend it. We'll go cut clips from there, and we'll play it for you next week.
That's right. We do it for you, because we love you. All right, the Adam Carolla Show returns tomorrow with Brad Williams in studio. We'll see you guys next weekend. My name's Chris. That's Gio.
Mahalo, and get it on.